you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at noon. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization. Hello, everyone. This is Politics and Science with your host, John Barkhausen, and I'm happy to say that I have contacted Dr. Christopher Busby, and he is on the line. Are you there, Dr. Busby?
Yes, I am, yeah.
And you can hear us all right?
I can't hear you very loud at the moment, no.
Okay, let me turn it up.
Hang on.
There we go. How's that?
Say again?
Is that better?
A little bit better. That'll do, yeah, sure.
Okay.
You can hear me all right, though.
I can hear you fine. You're coming through.
Good, great. Okay.
Dandy. So, I have a bio here for you. Dr. Christopher Busby is a British scientist known for his work on the health effects of ionizing radiation. In addition to his academic appointments, he is the director of Green Audit, an environmental consultancy agency, and scientific advisor to the Low-Level Radiation Campaign, which he set up in 1995. He's also a national speaker on science and technology for the Green Party of England and Wales. And you have several appointments. You're a fellow of the University of Liverpool and the Faculty of Medicine.
That's out of date now, actually.
Okay.
I'm actually now a visiting professor at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland.
Okay.
I think you've got the Wikipedia entry there, which somebody stuck up there.
I did.
Things have moved on since then. That went up some time ago. I'm a visiting professor at the University of Ulster in Northern Ireland. In the Faculty of Life and Health Sciences, and I'm also guest researcher at the German Agricultural Federal Research Laboratory in Brunswick, near Hanover. But mainly, what I am is the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk, which is an operation that was set up in 1997, supported by the Greens in the European Parliament to develop an alternative risk model for the health effects of low-dose radiation exposures.
And just a little background, how long have you been interested in radiation?
For my sorrow, I'm afraid. I've been working in this area for almost 20 years now. I started in about 1987, but I didn't really get going until the early 1990s.
And what was your entry? Was it in...
The novel, really.
I see.
Well, I lived in Wales, you know, and Wales, although it's 1,800 miles away from Chernobyl, received quite high levels of radioactivity that fell with the rain. The British National Radiological Protection Board, then, the agency which regulates the limits for exposure to humans, were quite bright about it all, saying, you know, it was all quite safe. But I was actually there at the time, and I was a bit concerned because I felt as if I was surrounded by invisible rays of death, you know. And this is a feeling that I actually later came to see was pretty accurate.
So your instincts have always told you that radiation is not...
Yes, that's right. I mean, I was a member of CND, in the...
What is that?
The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. So when I was a student, you know, I used to go on the marches to stop all the ban the bomb marches and so forth, because it seemed to me that, and in fact it seemed to everybody that I knew then, that the world was heading for imminent destruction in some kind of exchange between America and the Soviet Union. And that was a feeling that we had for a long time, right up until after the Berlin Wall came down. So I already had a little bit of understanding about the way in which radiation affected living systems, because as a member of CND, you know, in the 60s, we watched a number of films and we listened to various talks from scientists who then were arguing that the radioactivity from weapons fallout, because at that time, you know, in the 60s, well, in the late 50s and early 60s, they were doing a lot of atmospheric nuclear tests. When I say they, I mean the United States and the Soviet Union mainly, but mm-hmm. also the British too. And so there was a lot of new stuff in the environment, strontium-90, cesium-137, plutonium-241, all sorts of substances that never existed on Earth prior to 1945. And I'm quite an inquisitive sort of person, you know. I'm a scientist, and I try to understand things. So I tried to understand how these substances might affect living systems.
Mm.
So I was kind of set up. It was a bit difficult to resist that question. I mean, that's the big question, you know, which I've spent 20 years of my life trying to answer. Well, I have essentially answered it now, I think.
So I think a lot of the science done on radiation effects are based basically on physicists' work, and I noticed you have a degree in chemistry and biology. Is that right? Or
no, my degree is in chemistry and in chemical physics.
I see.
But essentially, I'm a chemist. I'm a physical chemist, really, mm-hmm. which is an odd sort of creature. A physical chemist is somebody who looks at chemistry from the point of view of physics, but certainly is not a physicist. I mean, physicists seem to be able to devise their systems entirely apart from any reality. I mean, what they do is they work mathematical procedures on measurements and then come up with theories about how these measurements prove what it is that they're proposing.
Mm.
But in chemistry, it's really much more down to earth. It's much more like electronics. And in fact, if you mix something with something else and you get a red precipitate, you know, then you have to explain the red precipitate. And every time you mix those two things together, you will still get a red precipitate. But in physics, it's much more mystical, really. And one of the problems with the development of theories of radiation action in the living cell is it never really considered the living cell. I mean, the early physicists who had to devise limits for health effects at the time of the Manhattan Project, and in fact I know about that now because I'm doing a court case at the moment in America on somebody who died who lived as a young man at Los Alamos.
Mm.
So I know a great deal about what went on. They devise these things as pure abstraction. So a man is considered to be like a bag of water. So it's like a sort of cylinder full of water, and you irradiate this cylinder from the outside by gamma rays, and then a certain amount of gamma radiation is absorbed by the water, and then that produces a dose, which is defined as energy per unit mass. And that approach was applied to the exposures from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they developed the relationship, which still exists, incidentally, and which underpins or supports all the risk limits that there are at the moment.
Yeah, I think that bears repeating. I talked to Rosalie Bertel, and that's what she was saying, that the actual safety standards for the USA, I think maybe it's changed in Europe, but are actually still based on that finding by those physicists back in, what, was it 1950?
Yes, that's right. And in fact, the interesting thing about that too also, and I no doubt she said this, is that those people only started in 1952 anyway. And so a great deal of the evidence that there was prior to then, because after all the bomb fell in 1945, so that's 7 years, just disappeared. You know, that data wasn't included. Lots and lots of people who might have been, I must tell you what they did is they drew up a group of people who were there at the time of the explosion, and they compared to a group of people who came into the city afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of those people will have died between 1945 and 1953. So Professor Alice Stewart, who's dead now, she was one of the first to point out that they're actually looking at a healthy group. They're looking at the survivors from the Hiroshima bombing. You know?
Mm.
And so that's not really relevant anyway, even for external photon high-energy radiation.
Just
our major beef with it is not that. Yeah. My major concern is that it doesn't distinguish between internal exposure, doesn't distinguish between the ingestion of uranium particles or ingestion of plutonium or cesium or these substances which are produced when a bomb explodes, because they were ingested and absorbed by both the control group, which came in afterwards, and the exposed group that was there at the time. So the numbers of cancers produced following this huge dose only relates to the huge dose. It doesn't relate to these internal doses. Now, if the internal doses pack a much greater punch, and radiation biology has shown since then that this is the case, then the whole thing, the whole edifice collapses.
I see. So perhaps for our listening audience, you could recap a little bit about what the difference is between gamma radiation and alpha radiation.
Of course, there are a number of different kinds of what's called radiation. I mean, I suppose they could be called different things, but they're called radiation and put into one bag. There's radiation in the sense of sunlight. So this is electromagnetic radiation. So it's exactly like light. If I shine a torch at you, that's visible radiation. And if I shine green light at you, it's green radiation. If I shine ultraviolet light, it's ultraviolet radiation. In every case, it's an electromagnetic disturbance of some sort, and it spreads out in a quite well-known way. And the same is true for very high-energy radiation called X-rays and gamma rays. So it's just that these radiations are invisible to us because our eyes don't detect them. But because they have such a high energy, they're capable of cutting through the bonds of molecules inside the body. And when they cut through these molecules, they produce fast electrons, because molecules are made up out of electron bonds. I mean, all the chemists among you will know this. So when you write a molecule like water, H2O, H-O-H, the little line you draw between H and O is a bond. Now, if a gamma ray photon cuts through that, destroys or is absorbed by the electrons in that bond, it kicks the electron out of that bond, and that electron goes off at a tremendous rate with a lot of energy. It takes up the energy of the gamma ray, and then it biffs into another molecule and breaks that, and then biffs into another one and breaks that, and just generally whizzes about the place like a little spark until it's busted up a load of molecules to produce what's called ions. And that's why it's called ionizing radiation. I mean, some of these ions are also not called ions. They're called radicals and radical pairs and all sorts of things. But anyway, generally speaking, they're very reactive. They could be called hot species, like little sparks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with this, of course, is that these things can attack DNA. And of course, when the physicists set up this model in the 50s, DNA hadn't even been discovered. But since then, we've discovered that cancer is caused by damage to DNA in various ways. And so these ions are the target for this ionization radiation in the sense of cancer and other diseases is DNA. Okay. Now, the other type of radiation is one in which certain atoms, unstable atoms, plutonium is an example, or uranium, or cesium, or strontium-90 is a good example. These are substances which are created when you fission uranium, when you break up uranium-235 in the bomb. It splits the uranium atom, and you get a whole host of little elements, some of which are very unstable and decay away quickly, and others are less unstable. For instance, strontium-90 has a half-life of about 30 years, 29 years. It takes that long for half of the strontium-90 produced to decay away. Now, these substances, when they decay, because they're unstable, they turn into something else. So the strontium-90 turns into yttrium-90, which is another chemical element. But when it does so, it shoots off an electron called a beta particle. This is a highly energetic particle, and it whizzes off, and it does all the same things that the electron I was telling you about when the gamma ray breaks the OH bond, exactly the same thing. So it's essentially, at the point of impact inside the body, the effect is identical. So if you like, the strontium-90, the beta emitter, directly produces the electron, whereas the photon energy, the gamma ray, produces it indirectly. And then you have a third type of radiation, which is called an alpha emitter. And certain elements, uranium is one, plutonium is one, americium-241, that's one, there are a number of them. They produce another sort of particle, which is a charged helium nucleus, doubly charged helium nucleus, which is called an alpha particle. And this particle is very slow and has a very short range. So unlike the electron, the beta electron, which has a range of about 400 cells, when you have a strontium 90 releasing its beta particle, it will crack its way through about 400 cells before it releases all its energy. The alpha particle is much slower and much bigger and much more highly charged, so it only really goes through 3 cells. And because it goes through 3 cells, it deposits vast amounts of energy into a much smaller distance. And so it's called a high linear energy transfer. And for this reason, alpha particles are considered to be very dangerous, or rather alpha emitters are considered to be very dangerous when they get inside you. Although outside you, they're relatively harmless, because these alpha particles can't get through the skin.
I see. Yeah, it seems a little counterintuitive, because I would think the beta particle affecting 400 cells would cause more damage.
Yes, well, they carry the same energy, see, that's the point. Or in fact, even a little bit less energy. So you know, the energy of a particle is proportional, it's basically its mass times its velocity, or it's a half mv squared, you know, or some relationship like that. And so, if you had a beta particle and an alpha particle, and they had exactly the same energy, 1 million electron volts, let's say, in the case of the beta particle, you're putting down 1 million electron volts into 400 cells, so each one gets 1/400th of 1 million electron volts, you know. So the actual energy per cell is a lot less.
I see. So it's less likely to do as much damage to those.
That's right, yeah. So with the alpha particle, you've got 1 million electron volts goes into each cell, you see. And in fact, the dose from a fat alpha particle to a cell is approximately 500 millisieverts. And that's quite a lot. And the normal dose, the way in which they measure doses, is millisieverts or milligrays. In America, I think it's rads still. I think they still use rads.
That's right,
rems,
yeah.
So it's millirems. But anyway, just to compare it, the dose from an alpha particle is 500 millisieverts, and the annual dose limit from the nuclear, you know, from the government to the whole body is 1 millisievert, you know. So the point is your cell gets a lot more than the annual dose limit just from one decay.
I get you. And I'm curious as to gamma radiation that the ICRP, their safety standards have been based on the gamma radiation dose, you're saying, all these years?
Yes, they are. They have been. I mean, they obviously had to deal with internal radiation, but what they do there is they just take the energy from the internal decay, from the alpha or from the beta, and they just dissolve it into the whole body. And this is a very important point, which I'm going to sort of say once, but and then if you don't understand it, but I'd better repeat it or in a different way. Because this is the key error in the ICRP risk model, and the one that has resulted in many, many inquiries that have concluded that increases in cancer in downwinders or in people living near nuclear plants or for people after Chernobyl or, you know, enormous numbers of cases where people have been shown, like uranium is a good example, you know, from Iraq, shown to be ill after exposure to these internal radionuclides. The inquiry has always found that the dose is too low. So we need to understand what is meant by dose. And I think I said earlier that what the ICRP does is it models the body as a bag of water. Now, that's okay if you imagine a bag of water standing outside at Hiroshima and a big flash bulb goes off, poof. You know, every bit of that bag of water, and if it's a human being, every cell in the body will get roughly the same amount of energy, you know, because it's light and it just travels out radially from its source. So averaging it is reasonable. I mean, and physicists made a reasonable assumption when they averaged it as energy per unit mass. But now let's take a piece of plutonium or a little piece of radioactive material and stick it inside that bag of water, say in the top left-hand corner, and just leave it there for a few years. Now, this little plutonium particle or uranium particle will kick off lots and lots of these alpha particles as it decays. I'm not talking about an atom now. I'm talking about an actual particle, about 1 micron across, like they have floating about in Iraq. Now, under those circumstances, a little part of that phantom, of that bag of water, will receive an enormous dose, absolutely enormous dose. But what the ICRP will do is take all of that energy from that dose and again dissolve it into the entire body. Now, that, of course, is the source of the error, because cancer starts in a single cell or in a small area of the body, in a small community of cells. It doesn't start in the whole body at once. Now, an example would be, for instance, and this is quite an accurate example, would be if I were to sit in front of a fire and to warm myself, I would get a dose there. It's exactly the same as a radiation dose, because the radiation from the fire is infrared radiation. It warms me up. And I would get a dose of so many joules per kilogram. I could measure the number of joules, and I know how what I weigh in kilograms, so I just divide one by the other. And it would give me a certain dose. But that would keep me quite warm and pleasant, you know, as I watched the television. But on the other hand, I could reach into the fire and pick out a red-hot coal and eat it. Now, the thing is, that would give me the same dose, you see.
Mm.
But it would kill me. I know it sounds absurd, but that is actually what they do.
Even though
the concept of dose is misapplied, it's an inadmissible use of scientific method.
I see.
It's what's called deduction rather than induction.
Can you explain that, induction and deduction?
Well, it was developed originally by William of Ockham in the 12th century. This is the scientific method, extremely powerful, and the scientific method basically involves induction. It's called scientific induction, and what it says is that what there is in common to different instances of a happening or of an event is the cause of or is related to the cause of that event. Okay, that's induction.
Mm.
So if we see, you know, nuclear sites in Europe and nuclear sites in, well, in England, nuclear sites in Germany, nuclear sites in Sweden, in France, and we see childhood leukemia near those nuclear sites, then the method of induction demands that we assume that the nuclear site is the cause of, or related to the cause of, the effect. But now, deduction, what that does is it uses a model based on some other theory. So you start with a theory with deduction, and you carry it forward, and you explain something on the basis of theory. And in terms of science, that is just a secondary method of doing things.
Hmm.
It's not acceptable philosophically. And I've said this in many arenas. But of course, you know, the scientists are not philosophers. Although they ought to be.
Well, yeah, science I think grew out of philosophy originally. But that's very.
Yes,
that's
of course it did. I mean, it used to be called natural philosophy, and in fact, the Royal Society, to whom I gave evidence, in the case of uranium. Yeah, here we are. This is John Stuart Mill. This is from the European Committee on Radiation Risk report, which I wrote or I edited in 2003. The classical exposition of the scientific or inductive method is what called Mill's canon. So the first one states that whatever there is in common between the antecedent conditions of a phenomenon can be supposed to be the cause or related to the cause of the phenomenon. And then there's a canon of difference, which states that the difference in the conditions under which an effect occurs and those under which it does not must be the cause or related to the cause of the effect. And then there are various other little things that you add on. But what you certainly cannot do is say, look, because the tiny doses that they got at these nuclear sites couldn't have caused leukemia in Japanese survivors of an atomic bomb, it couldn't possibly have caused leukemia in the children. But, you know, it's just completely different scientific approach. One is chronic exposure to internal radioactive substances, which never existed on Earth prior to 1945, and the other is people put out in the open and exposed to an enormous giant flash bulb.
Mm.
If it weren't for political and military pressure to develop bombs and to keep the world safe from the red peril and all the rest of that, you know, this would have been rumbled long ago.
Mm-hmm.
The people who would have rumbled it are the World Health Organization, and they were effectively gagged in 1959 when they were forced into an agreement with the other United Nations body called the International Atomic Energy Agency.
I see.
So in 1959, WHO signed an agreement with IAEA in which all of the research onto radiation and health was left in the hands of IAEA, and their remit is the peaceful development of nuclear power. This is a conflict of interest.
I get you. We're talking to Dr. Christopher Busby, who's a British scientist known for his work on the health effects of ionizing radiation, and we're discussing basically his current work on setting new standards for health effects of exposure to low doses of ionizing radiation and some of the history leading up to this new document that I think you're about to release. Is that right?
Yes. We've released one of the chapters of it on uranium. Is already we put that one on the internet for free, but the actual book itself is at the printers at the moment, and it should be released, hoping it will be released, it will be printed in time for April the 26th.
So it sounds like you're saying that the major mistake that's been made by these other regulatory agencies in setting standards for radiation doses is that they've been using models, mathematical models, instead of actually looking at the reality.
Yes, absolutely.
Of the situation.
In fact, I think, to be honest, and having studied this, for me, the philosophy of this is actually more interesting than the science. The science is quite straightforward, really. But the philosophy is not straightforward, because you have to ask yourself why it is that scientists, you know, people presumably intelligent, persist in this notion that they can apply these external risk models to internal risk. I'm really at a loss to understand how it works. I know from my own experience that there's an awful lot of pressure put on scientists, but you would think more people would break. I mean, a number of them have. I mean, Ed Radford in America resigned from the ICRP on a similar sort of issue. And who else? John Goffman, he got kicked out by the
Atomic Energy Commission.
Energy Commission. Yeah. And there are a few heroes, but precious few. It's almost like scientists are sheep, you know, and they just want to be part of the gang rather than actually think for themselves.
Well, let's talk about the politics of the science of studying radiation in the radiation industry. What does happen when you break ranks with the status quo in a scientific situation?
Well, I mean, it's like Gandhi said, first they laugh at you, then they attack you, then you win. It is kind of like that. I mean, when I first started, they just laughed at me. You know? They said, "Who are you? Some banjo player from the mountains?" But I just persisted, you know. And I eventually got my stuff into the media by just cleverness, by chaining myself up to nuclear power stations and writing little books and pamphlets. I taught myself to print. And bought a second-hand printing press, which needed doing up. And I taught myself to make it. And it's quite hard. This is litho printing.
Yeah.
And I did all of this stuff, you know, and produced leaflets and went around the place talking and spreading the message. And of course, because I'm basically right, because it's so blindingly obvious, you know, that I'm right. And not because of anything to do with how great I can, you know, my great performance or any of that stuff. I think that I eventually, by about 1996, when I wrote the first book, I persuaded a big Quaker charity to fund me for 6 months or a year to write a book called Wings of Death, which lays out what I'd found at that time. And this was an extraordinarily influential book, and it got me invited all over the place and attacked violently by, you know, the nuclear industry and all their buddies.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of it was quite plausible, and certainly the epidemiology was interesting, you know, people tended to believe it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main epidemiological finding that I presented in that book was a comparison of the cancer rates in Wales and England. Now England and Wales have very good cancer registries, which go right back. And so the data is quite easily available, and you can look at cancer rates in England and Wales. But the interesting thing is that because Wales is much wetter, where I live here, it's much rainier, there's a lot more strontium-90. There's a lot more weapons fallout. And all this stuff was measured by the British Agricultural Research Laboratory, so that data is available as well. So it's really quite a simple but rather tedious process to put all this stuff together and to show that there's a very powerful correlation between the increase in cancer in Wales, because what happened after the weapons fallout, cancer increased in Wales, but not in England, you see, and then it started to increase in England later on.
Hmm.
So you could relate these two to the weapons fallout, and you came out with a factor of 300, being the error factor in the risk model of the ICRP. And so I presented that in 1995. Of course, everybody screamed and yelled. And then I started the low-level radiation campaign with a colleague and a girlfriend. And that was very successful. We produced a journal, Radioactive Times. Incidentally, we did this all on very little money, you know. Nobody gave us any money. The Edward Goldsmith gave us a little bit of money. And Sir James Goldsmith gave us a new printing press, a really nice one, which I've still got, actually. And so we printed our way through various campaigns. And then the Irish government, I went over to Ireland to talk about Sellafield. We have a reprocessing plant here on the Irish Sea, which dumps all its radiation into the Irish Sea.
Mm.
And there was a court case being brought by some people in Ireland against England, because Ireland doesn't have any nuclear power, you know. So it was concerned that it might be receiving effects from Sellafield. So I got a job working as a project, which I set up to look at health effects of people living near the Irish Sea. And I found that people living near the Irish Sea had about a 40% increased risk of cancer if they lived within 800 meters of the sea. And we found that we could explain that on the basis of measurements that were made of plutonium that was brought ashore by sea spray. And incidentally, this effect also occurs in America, because I've done some work that, on data that Joe Mangano gave me on Millstone, the Millstone reactor in New England, where is it, Connecticut. And that shows the same sort of effect. You know, you get high levels of leukemia near the coast because of this exposure to salt spray containing the radioactive substances which get dumped into the sea. And Millstone is a really dirty reactor. It dumps all this stuff into the sea.
So you're saying that that spray produces something that you actually ingest?
You inhale it. You don't ingest it, no.
Oh, I see.
Ingestion isn't too bad, incidentally.
Oh.
What we've discovered is that the transfer coefficients for these substances from ingestion are not very great. It's inhalation that's the problem. They go up the nose and into the lung, and then straight through into the lymphatic system, and then into the bloodstream, just like that. The reason we know this is because there have been measurements made in this country of people living near the sea. So, you know, this is not just like some crazy theory. We measured the plutonium near the sea, and then there were measurements made that were published of the autopsies, you know, the corpses. So people who died, they got, I think, 400 or 500 people, and they cut them up and looked inside their chests and found the plutonium. So you've got much more plutonium if you live near the sea than if you live inland.
And that's only if you live near a reprocessing plant? Is that a recycling, nuclear recycling?
It's a reprocessing plant.
I see. Sure. So that's what they're trying to sell here in the United States now. The nuclear power industry is in a big push to sell us new reactors, and recycling is the panacea they're selling to...
I don't understand recycling. I mean, you mean reprocessing, so you're going to take the plutonium and burn it in mixed oxide fuel. Is that the thing?
I think so, and somehow they're going to new fuel out of it.
I mean, that's possible, but the point is that all it does is it deals with a little bit of the plutonium. It doesn't deal with all the other crap, you know. I mean, there's just enormous amounts of this stuff that comes out. Plutonium is just one of the isotopes. You've got americium, you've got neptunium, you've got strontium, you've got tritium, you've got carbon-14, you've got a whole witch's brew of cobalt-60, you've got an enormous lot of stuff that comes out, and there's nowhere to put it, you know, and a lot of it's gaseous, you know, so you can't stop it coming out. Strontium-90, for instance, starts life as a gas.
I see.
So you can't filter it, you can't keep the strontium-90 in. It comes out as a gas, and instantly it turns into strontium-90 and then floats about. So people inhale it, it gets into the milk. They drink the milk, it gets into their bones and into the DNA. And that's another thing we found as the ECRR. So this new report that's coming out, I'd better say. You know, we found that there was about this 300-fold error. The question is, why is it that number? There's been a big study recently in Germany of children living near nuclear plants, you know, and that shows an increase in leukemia. Be interpreted on the basis of an error factor of about 1,000. And I published a paper recently in the Journal of Environmental and Public Health, in which I looked at children who were born after the Chernobyl accident in Europe, who had been in the womb at the time of the fallout, you know, the Chernobyl fallout.
Yeah.
So this is a very precise group of children. This is a cohort, we call them, that is chosen exactly because they were only in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl fallout. And they show an increase in infant leukemia, and the error factor there is 600. So, you know, wherever we go and we look at these numbers, we find this error factor of between 300 and 1,000. So that does seem to be approximately the... there's another one. Martin Tondell, a scientist in northern Sweden. I think he was at Linköping, or maybe Uppsala, anyway. He did a study of cancer in the small areas of northern Sweden after Chernobyl. That was published in 2004, and that showed quite strongly, highly significantly, an 11% increase in cancer per 100 kilobecquerels per square meter of cesium-137 contamination. And it's easy to show that that level of contamination produces a dose which results in an error factor of the ICRP model of about 650. So you see that everywhere you look, you get this error factor for internal radiation exposures. And this is, like, in my opinion, this is the public health scandal of human history.
So you're talking about these two models, the old model that everybody's been using being that inaccurate by that factor, 600 to 1,000.
Correct, and that's enabled the continuous contamination since 1945.
Yeah, what's the significance of these models and the fact that the standards are just so far off? What's the
significance? Yeah. That is the significance. The significance is that the model that they use at the moment is wildly inaccurate for exposure to internal radionuclides. So, in other words, any operation of a nuclear power station or any releases of internal radionuclides from the stacks of a reprocessing plant or from the boilers of a nuclear submarine or whatever. The extent to which that then gets absorbed by human beings or by fish or by animal life or whatever, plant life, is going to cause the destruction, of that plant life or animal life or human life by a factor which is much, much larger than is currently believed. So in other words, the simplest way of looking at it is that the present limits should only apply to external radiation, so that they're fine for X-rays and things like that. But for internal radiation, they should be dropped by a factor of 600, and probably different for different radiations if one wanted to get nitpicky about it.
Yeah. And the significance of that, I would think...
Well, the significance of that is the end of the nuclear industry. Or else, and in fact, people say, are you anti-nuclear? And I always say, if we're talking about democracy here, and I'm not sure myself about democracy, although I'm a Green Party speaker, if we're talking about democracy, then democracy depends upon people knowing the truth. You have to have perfect knowledge for democracy. Now, in the 19th century, when democracy was set up, by and large, politicians knew the score. So if there was some policy being mooted, do this or do that, the politicians themselves would have a good understanding of what was going on, and they could make a choice, or human beings, working for them, or the public, or whatever. But nowadays, that's no longer true. We have to depend upon these arcane mathematical, arm wavings that we see coming from the International Commission on Radiological Protection, and it's just wrong. People are dying because of this. And in fact, last year, I met with the ICRP scientific secretary, Jack Valentin, in Stockholm. We had a public debate. He just resigned then. Because the pressure on the ICRP is now getting so great that it's becoming embarrassing. Evidence is coming out from all over the place that this model is completely wacko. So you've got evidence from Chernobyl. Alexei Yablokov has just written an enormously fat book, which was published by the New York Academy of Sciences, on the real effects of Chernobyl. And there's effects coming out in uranium weapons, uranium areas, like Fallujah, where you've got all these birth deformities and so on. So the ICRP are under vast pressure. And the ICRP risk model guy, the man who was like the chief wizard, if you like, since 1988, was a Swedish guy called Jack Valentin. And he resigned this last year, 2009. And he met with me in Stockholm, and he said two very important things. And this is all on video. We're going to stick it on YouTube, incidentally. I just haven't got around to it because I'm so busy. But he said, firstly, that the ICRP risk model cannot be used to predict the effects of exposure of human populations. Quite clearly he said that. And I said, well, what's it for then? He said, it's just to get a rough idea. And I said, well, why can't it be used? Because frankly, if I was a politician, I'd be quite concerned by what you said. And he said, because there are very large uncertainties. And I said, well, what level of uncertainties? He said, maybe two orders of magnitude. Well, that's where they're home and dry, aren't we? 500, two orders of magnitude.
Hmm.
And this is the man himself. He's, I mean, if you look at the ICRP 2007 model, there he is. I mean, you know, it says ICRP 2007, Health Effects of Low-Dose Radiation, Jack Valentin. And then also the other one, the one that came before it, was the 1990 ICRP 60, also edited by Jack Valentin. And also you might wonder how all this manages to stay together, you know. What's the kind of glue that holds all this stuff together, this crap? And the truth is that there are actually not that many people involved. If you take the Bayer reports, and I mean, if you take the main committees that look at this stuff, there's the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, one.
Yeah.
Then you get the NCRP, which is, and then you get the ICRP, and then you've got the NRPB in England, National Radiologic Protection Board, now called the HPA. They keep changing their names. Then the International Atomic Energy Agency. And if you look at the personnel on these committees, they're all the same people. It's extraordinary. And in fact, I've put a whole page of that in the ECRR report that's coming out. Because, you know, because what happens is that if governments go to the ICRP or to NRPB or HPA or whatever, and they say, how do you know that you're right? Because this guy Busby says, you know, that you might be wrong. They say, oh, well, we consult with the ICRP. But they are the ICRP.
Mm.
Or they say, oh, we consult with the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. But if you look in UNSCA, you find they're all the same people. So they don't have very far to go to consult with these people, because they just have to pick up the phone and talk to themselves.
So you're saying it's basically a small club.
Rosalie Bertel was one of the first people to point that out. It's a self-selected club of people who work for the nuclear industry, and its job, you know, like all political jobs, is to maintain the status quo. And the argument, the political argument, is that we need this stuff. So who cares if a few people die, because we need the bombs. I mean, that's essentially it. You know, it's a kind of military operation. It's a bit like the use of uranium. You know, everyone's squealing about the use of uranium. And what they ought to say is, look, we used uranium because we wanted to defeat Saddam Hussein, you know, and we don't really care if everybody dies in Iraq, because we don't care about the Iraqis, you know. Who are they to us?
So
that's what they really think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But of course, they'd never dare say that, because nowadays, you know, it's all PC. You have to. But in the Second World War, you know, they wouldn't have two thoughts about it. You know, this is the military. That's what they do.
So this is probably the subject for an entire other show. I'd like to stick to more to more general issues here about radiation and the history of its use.
In any way, just ask.
But depleted uranium you're referring to in Iraq, they use there, and we were told over here at the time that, of course, there's no health effects from depleted uranium. I heard that from my congressperson. And
yeah.
I heard that from some health professionals, too.
They do is they apply the risk model of the ICRP. I mean, nobody actually looks at the data. They just look at the doses, and they say that uranium is very weakly radioactive, ordinary uranium, and depleted uranium is 40% less radioactive, so it must be less harmful than ordinary uranium. And that's the kind of the level of the argument. I mean, I saw a letter to the paper recently where some bloke wrote that. The problem is that they actually use rather a lot of it. That's the point. So although it might be 40% less radioactive than ordinary uranium, they dropped 350 tons on Iraq in 1991. And measured as actual total radioactivity. Now, by that I mean number of disintegrations per second. That amount of uranium is equivalent to about 2 kilograms of plutonium, which is much more radioactive.
Hmm.
Now, if they'd have dropped 2 kilograms of plutonium on Iraq, you know, they'd have all been sent off to Nuremberg. So you have to be a little bit careful about the science here. Now, there's another point about uranium, which is actually my own discovery, because I've been researching uranium since 1996, I think. Yeah, that's right. I was one of the first people to suggest that Gulf War syndrome was caused by uranium. I went out to Iraq in 2001 and measured uranium on the battlefield there, and also I went to Kosovo where NATO forces had fought and used uranium weapons. So I've been looking at this uranium business for some time. I gave evidence to the Royal Society in 2001, and then I was a member of the British Depleted Uranium Oversight Board, and I was joint author of their final report. Uranium has a very curious property, which ought to have been noticed, but wasn't, which is that it has a very high atomic number. Now, you know that, that if you look at a periodic table, if you look at all the elements on Earth, you get little small elements like hydrogen, and then they go up to bigger elements, you know, lithium and beryllium and boron, and then they go to metal elements, lead and so on. But the element with the highest atomic number, that's the most electrons, on the bottom right-hand corner of the periodic table is uranium, 92 electrons it's got. Hmm. Now, it does turn out, and this is just standard physics that's been known for many, many years, you know, since the 19th century. Is that right? No, maybe the 20th century. Anyway, certainly known throughout the 20th century, that elements absorb gamma radiation and X radiation in proportion to the fourth power of their atomic number. So in other words, hydrogen, if you beam some gamma radiation at water, we can model water as oxygen, which has got an atomic number of 8. So if you take the relative absorption of water, and we'll assume that we're made of water, you can say it's like 8 times 8 times 8 times 8, you know, whatever that is, 264. But if you get uranium, the absorption of uranium inside you is 92 times 92 times 92 times 92, which is like a very large number. And I can tell you that sum gives you an increased absorption of gamma radiation by the uranium inside you of a factor of about 250,000. You know, so in other words, if you've got uranium inside you, that uranium it acts as a sort of antenna for natural background radiation, and we're all exposed to natural background radiation. So in other words, the uranium doesn't even have to be radioactive. You know, it just relies entirely upon its high atomic number. Now that in itself wouldn't necessarily be a problem, except that uranium has an enormous affinity for DNA, and this was discovered in the 60s. When they started to look for elements that would bind to DNA in order to do electron microscopy. And they discovered that the affinity constant for DNA was very large. And an American called Nielsen in 1992 found that the affinity constant was about 10 to the 10, which is very big. What it means is that at normal, you know, quite modest contamination with uranium, even the sort of uranium contamination that you might find normally in nature, you would get uranium binding to the DNA. And so when you then look through the literature to follow that up, you find, lo and behold, people who are living in areas of high levels of uranium, and uranium miners, and anyone who's exposed to uranium, has a very high level of chromosome damage. So in other words, something is cutting their DNA into pieces. So uranium is actually probably one of the most dangerous elements that there are. And it's not particularly about its low level of radioactivity. It's about the fact that it does this phantom, what's called secondary photoelectron effect. Because when it absorbs this gamma ray, it shoots off a photoelectron. And if it's a particle, you know, and most of these weaponized uranium exposures are due to little particles of about 1 micron or less, maybe 100 nanometers. Actually, I think the mean diameter is about 0.8 of a micron. So it just floats into your nose, floats up into your brain, incidentally. They've done experiments in America with rats, in France, with rats inhaling uranium particles, and it goes straight into the center of the brain, into the hippocampus.
That's a nanoparticle.
Yeah, well, they're not quite nanoparticles. They're larger than that.
Oh.
They're sort of like intermediate between microparticles and nanoparticles.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if there probably are nanoparticles as well. But anyway, certainly the experiments that have been done at the Aberdeen Proving Ground, where they've measured this stuff, the mean aerodynamic diameter of these particles is about 800 nanometers. And my colleagues who do the nanoparticle stuff at the University of Ulster, they wouldn't really class that as a nanoparticle. they like to think a nanoparticle is like 10 nanometers or maximum 50 nanometers, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, the point is that these things then act as secondary sources for photoelectrons, and they then act like these little... like little hot sparks, you know, again.
Mm-hmm.
But they're there all the time. So as long as they don't have to, it's not a question of them being radioactive. It's just that so long as they're in the body, they're sucking in the gamma radiation from the natural background and re-emitting it into the DNA as photoelectrons. Now, if that DNA happens to be DNA in the hippocampus, then it just deranges you. So you get all of these effects that the Gulf War syndrome people were complaining about. You know, all these kind of strange housekeeping effects like giddiness and loss of memory and sweating attacks and diarrhea and bowel problems, incontinence, you know, all this weird stuff.
So, Dr. Christopher...
Which everybody said must be due to stress.
Dr. Busby, we only have about 2 minutes left.
And okay, sorry, I've been guessing on
it. No, that's, it's very interesting, and I'd like to spend some more time at some point when you, when you're not whizzing about. But I'd like to... You just said the Gulf War syndrome was caused by depleted uranium, possibly. And it, you're, it sounds like you're saying radiation, we always think of it as causing cancer, but you're saying there's many illnesses that can be caused by radiation before you actually have cancer?
Absolutely. It causes every kind of illness. The process through which it does this is called genomic instability, and it's now well known, and this is seen in the survivors of the Chernobyl disaster, and it's seen in survivors of the Hiroshima bombing. You get just about every disease it's possible to get is associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, because basically it's just damaging DNA, and it's DNA that regulates your body.
Mm-hmm.
So if you smash up the DNA, you know, everything's going to go wonky.
So with 1 minute to go, Dr. Christopher Busby, a British scientist working on ionizing radiation, you sounded fairly optimistic about the prospects for getting these new standards in place. And why is that?
Well, I'm by nature an optimist, but I'm optimistic because I see the evidence as slowly building up. I mean, you can't. There are some things that you just cannot keep quiet. You know, I mean, and the evidence is just so enormous that to continue to sustain this outdated and ridiculous model in the face of the huge amount of evidence from all over the place that it's just plainly wrong is just impossible, in my opinion.
I see. So even
so, I think it will have to fail at some point.
Mm. So even with the political pressure to maintain the status quo and the nuclear industry and the military complex,
We do have a democratic procedure. I mean, and so we can take the war to Washington. I mean, the veterans in America have managed to swing it so that there's a reopening of the question of the origin of Gulf War syndrome, and I sent off evidence to that, and I'm prepared to go along there and show, give examples of all the things that I've said to you.
Well, great. That's,
and if there's any honesty in the world, and of course, you know, I am an optimist, I have to say, if there is any honesty in the world, and I think there are honest people in the world, I think that we will prevail. Eventually, we will prevail.
All right. Well, Dr. Christopher Busby, I really appreciate you coming on. And
okay, thank you.
Yeah, good night. And that was Dr. Christopher Busby. From his home in England.
If you have any questions for Politics and Science, you can direct them by email to politicsandscience@madriver.com. That's politicsandscience@madriver.com. Politics and Science can be heard weekly on WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, airing on Mondays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at noon. And in the Bellows Falls area, can be heard on Wool LP Bellows Falls at 101.1 FM, airing from 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays and from 9 to 10 a.m. on Mondays. Politics and Science presents the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of any other person or organization.